We are back. Thanks for sticking around, folks. As promised, here's my interview from earlier today with John Asimakopoulos. And the concept is this notion of transformative studies and what it means as a discipline. They've organized a bunch of academics and sociologists have gotten together and started this think tank, essentially about the way forward, about rethinking our basic values and who and what we are as a people. So I hope you enjoy this. We'll be back as soon as it's done. Stick around. I'm here with John Asimakopoulos, talking about a concept, actually, which is relatively new to me. So, John, I'll ask you right off the bat, help my listeners understand the concept of transformative studies.
Well, basically, anybody can teach you something, and you can learn whatever it is that they're teaching you. But myself and my colleagues, we got together and we said, you know, the way things are going, and it doesn't take me or anybody else to convince you of this, the way things are going today in society is terrible. And we can't just go back to doing the same old over and over, which I believe was the message of pretty much all of the candidates that were running, mm-hmm. including, of course, Obama. So the bottom line is we have to really engage in some transformative action that will really change how we've been doing things up to now. We can no longer have business as usual. So the idea is learn something that will fundamentally change the way things are. And in order to engage in fundamental change, whether it's the transformative presidency of President Obama or anything else, in order to truly transform something, you have to start with education. Mm-hmm. You have to explain to people what exactly it is that we want to transform and why. If I don't explain to you why we need a fundamental change in how we're doing things, why would you want to support it? So it all starts with education, and maybe we're biased ourselves because we're all more or less educators, but that was the basic idea, that we have to educate people like they used to do in the old days. People don't know their history. They don't know that in the 1800s, the labor movement, in the 1960s and 50s with the civil rights movement, a very big component of these movements was, in fact, education. You have to explain to people what it is that's wrong today and what it is that we're fighting for in the future.
That makes perfect sense. It seems we've gotten so far afield of what even America stands for. When you hear the debate that's going on politically, it seems we've drifted so far from the very essence of what this nation was founded on.
It is unbelievable. I mean, if anyone were to check out our website, because we also have a website presence, mm-hmm. at transformativestudies.org, we have quotes from, of course, Thomas Jefferson. And if anybody were to read these quotes from Thomas Jefferson today, not knowing where they're coming from, I mean, you'll be branded a traitor, mm-hmm. a lunatic, I mean, a communist, all sorts of nasty things, because, as you said, we have strayed so far away from what the founding principles of this nation were that it's almost impossible to identify it anymore. I mean, the levels of inequality that we have, how can I pursue my rights to life, liberty, and happiness when I'm homeless, mm-hmm. when I can't afford health care and I'm dying because doctors are asking me for insurance before they even look at me? Just the whole thing, I think, it's flipped on its head. It's terrible.
So what are the basic some of the basic principles that your group is putting forward that we should be what's the objective? What's the goal? What are we striving for?
The bottom line is that we do not believe in the privatization of some important services that anybody would need in order to survive. Mm-hmm. We think that privatization is not the answer. More specifically, there should be no private healthcare system. Mm-hmm. The United States is one of the only industrialized countries that actually officially, with a straight face, will say that healthcare is a commodity. It's a service, it's a product, it's something to be bought and sold, not a right. We believe that nationalized, guaranteed, quality healthcare, like many other countries have, is a fundamental right. And you should not have to worry about whether or not you send your child to have important surgery or you lose your house. That's unthinkable. And if if you were to listen to interviews from all these different shows about how other people in the world perceive us, they think of us as being barbarians. They said, no way, we definitely don't want the American healthcare system. And you don't have to be someone that necessarily sees eye to eye with our ideology on everything to say that, look, this is a real point here. Being able to have your healthcare is not a commodity. That's a right. It's the most basic thing. But to move on, in addition to healthcare, we also think that education should be a universal right. Mm-hmm. No one should have to say, well, sorry, son, I can't send you to school or to college because, one, we can't get loans, the credit markets are frozen, and two, we have no cash. An education is a right. And I also don't believe that we should have a two-tiered system where those who are privileged can go to the Ivy Leagues, graduate with an education not much more different than someone who went to, a state college or university, but then have all these other opportunities because they went to a Harvard, Princeton, or Yale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you look at who these people are graduating, like former President Bush from Yale, you have to wonder what exactly it is that they're teaching their students there that's so much better than the state universities.
I can vouch for that. Actually, I went to one of those fancy universities, and the hardest part about it was getting in. Once you're there, I mean, I came from a blue-collar background, but once you're there, they go to great lengths to make sure you can succeed and stay there. The level of difficulty, the quality of education wasn't that much different from my friends from high school who went to other schools and state schools and what have you. It was pretty much just getting in the door was the hard part. And again, on education, going back to the founders, that is one of the founders recognized at the time and have written that without an educated populace, this notion of representative government doesn't work. And John Adams even went so far as to write that into the Massachusetts Constitution, that it was the duty of the society to educate its people.
Absolutely. And without that basic level of education amongst the populace, then you wind up with policies that we were speaking about before, where you have the unimaginable, such as private profits on the one hand, but socialized risk.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are not going to be the beneficiaries of, these hedge funds and these creative banking instruments like the credit default swaps, which are really destroying the global economy right now. But when it comes to their risk, them having to pay the piper, they don't. They come back to the taxpayer and expect us, who had nothing to do with any of this, to pick up the tab. Since when?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is socialism in the most perverse possible world imaginable. But to continue with what we stand for, in addition to guaranteed health care, guaranteed education, we also believe in guaranteed quality housing, universal mm-hmm. housing. We also believe in guaranteed minimum living standards. Because once you have these elements, then you're truly free. You're truly free to think. You're truly free to speak. You're truly free to decide where you want to work, the type of work you want to do. And you're no longer controlled by a dictatorial employer or being in a position where you can't do anything other than trying to survive from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
That's not democracy.
One of the things I think you guys stand for as well, the role of the corporation in our politics and in our daily lives. I think you probably share this as well, that the corporations have become much too powerful in this country. And it's, again, it's supposed to be we the people, not we the conglomerate of multinational corporations.
Absolutely, Jeff. And in my own writings, I always make the statement that corporations and the upper class are indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot pretend that the two are not the same. However, in law, we do pretend that corporations are their own legal entity, and we give them powers that even individuals don't have. When was the last time that you can take all of your income, declare it in some tax haven, pay nothing to the U.S. Treasury, to the IRS, but when it comes to you and me, every dollar we make gets taxed over and over and over, and it's not as if these tax dollars are going to support education or health care. They're going to support wars, which are quite unpopular. They're going to support bailouts for the hyper-rich, which caused the problems to begin with because of their greed. It's unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And these corporations, a lot of people don't realize, they were never meant to live in perpetuity. Originally, the charter of a corporation had time limits. You couldn't have one forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we're giving them powers today that, you know, back in the day, even the founding fathers would never have imagined to give to such entities.
And it's and then we get in a situation where that we find ourselves in now, where we have these companies that are quote unquote too big to fail, and the government is and the taxpayers become the basically their salvation.
Yes, and I remember hearing a comment that not that long ago about how maybe we should have seen the banking industry as a utility, no different from a public utility company that would provide you with your heat or electricity. So what happened is we allowed these industries and these particular companies within the industries to grow so large, as you said, that if they were to collapse, like AIG, which is now in the news, mm-hmm. it would be disaster all throughout the world. Because what they provide us with in a capitalist economy is important. We have to have it. But here's something that the average person is not aware of, talking about education. AIG in of itself has gotten into the credit default swap market in the tune of roughly $64 trillion. And the world of the credit default swap market, the overall market itself, is about, globally now, is about $600 trillion. Now, I don't want to get too technical and explain yet again what these credit default swaps are, but I think it's safe to say that they were very shoddy instruments. Mm-hmm. They were ill-conceived. And if one considers that the GDP of the United States is $14 trillion, that puts it into perspective in terms of how deep this hole is that we're looking at. If even a fraction of that $64 trillion of AIG were bad, where's that money going to come from?
Right. Exactly. In some cases, we paid more for banks than there were. I mean, many times more than their listed worth. And where's all that? I mean, where's all that money gone? We've spent. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think on the Merrill Lynch or whatever that whoever owns Merrill Lynch now, we paid almost four times what the company was actually listed as being worth.
But when it comes to helping a poor family mm-hmm. who is in over its head with a house, well, we got to punish them if they made the wrong decisions.
Mm-hmm. So how do we get there? How do we open people's eyes? How do we get the word out? How do we re-educate the American populace to rethink our nation? And how do we get out of this mess, I guess, is the question.
I have a formula that starts with counter-ideology. And again, I don't want to get too technical, but here we have those in charge of the existing system telling us all is good, things will get better, don't worry too much, we know what we're doing. I think it's about time for us to call them on it. I think it's about time to have people say the emperor really does not have any clothes on. And that's counter-ideology. We have to start challenging what we're being told as the truth, because mm-hmm. it's not the truth. And as long as you don't have people willing to go out into the public and start challenging openly the authorities to tell us this is how things are, nothing's going to happen. So you have to have the people who are willing to challenge how things are, which is also tied into academic freedom. You can't have anyone take risks, go out, speak the truth, if they're afraid that when they come home, they'll be out of a job, because a president of a college or a politician or someone said, this person is trouble, let's get them out of here. Let's take their job away, let's make sure they don't have that platform to speak from. So you have to have academic freedom. You have to have people who will be able to go out there and speak the truth and not be part of the same dialogue. Repeating the existing arguments is not going to help anybody. So we have to be radical. We have to be willing to say, yes, I depart from what you're saying. This is not my common wisdom. I don't share your point of view. So challenge things with counter-ideology, which then brings us to the importance of having free and independent media, just like your show.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can talk until I'm blue in the face, but who's going to hear me if all the major channels refuse to have me on as a guest? How am I going to be able to spread the message when the New York Times would laugh if I even attempted to approach them? So don't expect the mainstream media to be an ally in this. They're not. Mm-hmm. If anything, they are corporations themselves that are owned by the very same companies that put us into the position we are today. So we have to look at independent media. And again, those of us who are students of history would know that the labor movement back in the 1800s, the civil rights movement in more recent times, all of these mass movements relied on their own independent media. They owned it and they operated it themselves. That's how you get your message out. And the internet today, it's a great resource. Let's hope that it stays neutral and free, because mm-hmm. as you know, they're also trying to kill that last bastion of freedom.
Yep.
But to finish up the thought, once you have the people who will challenge the existing ideology, once you have that free media, then you have to engage in education, which is why we started the nonprofit that we have, our think tank. You have to have real education, and I hate to say this, and I am an academic myself, employed with a major university. They will not do this for many, many, many reasons. So you have to have also independent educational institutions, mm-hmm. workers' colleges. And that's how you engage in social movement building. It takes time. It's not something you're going to do in a night or two.
Right. Obviously, it's something. It's a long-term process. I think. I mean, speaking about media, I think one of the big problems we have is the consolidation of media. That so few entities own so much of what is broadcast out there, and so much of it is. I was having a discussion yesterday with someone from the New York Times. This whole notion of self-censorship now that we see in the media, that the reporters and journalists are almost afraid to break from the corporate line, and I think the self-censorship is probably even more chilling than government-imposed censorship, because it squeezes the mind in terms of what it can think and where it can go.
That is true, and that's the exact same problem that academics face. Mm-hmm. We know that technically we have freedom of speech. Technically, this is not a dictatorship. You can still speak your mind, and nobody's going to come in the middle of the night and take you to the gulag. But, as you said, what's going to happen to you if you lose your job? Who's going to pay your mortgage? Mm-hmm. Who's going to pay for your children's clothing and education? So what a lot of people wind up doing is engaging in self-censorship. You know that if you're a reporter and you're going to report on a story that really speaks ill of, let's say, Robert Murdoch, and you work for him, there's going to be a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but you know it's going to come.
And you may not even have to criticize him directly. It could be some business that he's involved in somewhere. So you're constantly walking on eggshells, afraid of who you may offend and whether or not you'll have a job next week.
Absolutely, which is why we also support this brand-new concept to have a form of tenure for reporters.
Hmm.
This way, if a reporter does have legally guaranteed job security, which is what really tenure means,
mm-hmm.
Then maybe you'll have a little, and even then it's not assured, but at least you'll have more freedom, more guarantees to be able to say what you really think. But if your entire livelihood depends on these people, which is exactly how the system was set up, so they can keep control, once, you know, when they control your livelihood, they pretty much control what you can say, then there really isn't any freedom of the press. And this is also true, I believe, of academia. When you're afraid that your job may be in peril, you may not say the radical stuff that you really want to tell people.
Mm-hmm. And that they need to know. Yeah.
And that they have to know. Yeah. They have to know. This affects everyone.
You also, your group is also involved with an organization called Sociologists Without Borders. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that.
Yes. This is one of our newest partners that we have brought into our consortium. And as the name would imply, we are academics, we're sociologists, that try to bring about the changes that we're speaking of, not just within the United States, but also globally. Because in this environment, you cannot speak of change that's isolated from the rest of the world. In fact, that would be one of the worst things you can do. Globalization, whether we like it, is here to stay. It's not going to go anywhere. The question is, what kind of globalization? And that's what most people are not aware of, that just because things are the way they are now, with free trade agreements, with agreements that have no labor protections, no environmental protections, no basic citizenship rights. It doesn't have to be like this. we can still have globalization on far more egalitarian terms, terms that are fair both to the less powerful nations, terms that are fair to the citizens of the developed nations, and the list can go on and on and on. And this is one of the things that Sociologists Without Borders is trying to accomplish, to be able to create a global solidarity, maybe a global movement for positive change. It's not going to privilege one or two multinational corporations and the five or six stockholders, majority stockholders that own them, but rather the citizens of the planet, the majority of the people who are now suffering.
Wow. John, if people want to learn more about, you mentioned transformativestudies.org. Is that the main website for people to find out more about the work, the great work you're doing?
Yes. People can read much more about us on our website. We have a number of programs. We run a fellowship program for independent scholars. And it's all at transformativestudies.org.
Wow. I'm so heartened to hear that there are actually people out there organizing and thinking along these terms and trying to think about ways to help get this information to a wider audience so we can start. Obviously, we're all watching our way of life and a lot of our society kind of fall and crumble, and been trying to devote a lot of time and energy on this program to what do we build in its place? What's the next step for us? How do we survive this coming slow emergency? I think it was called by one author I talked to, and then what do we rebuild moving forward?
Yes, and if I can share this with you, when we started this project, at first we were very doubtful if we would be able to generate a lot of support. We said, look, let's avoid various titles and labels because we find that to be counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
We said, let's just tell people what we stand for, and they can label us whatever they wish. But much to our surprise, there's so much demand out there, so many people, both in the general public and the academic audience and the professional classes. There's so many people out there from so many walks of life that when we come in contact with them, they say to us, where have you been? And that comes back to the media. When you don't have media to promote a message, obviously that message is not going to be spread. And that's what they depend on. People in power depend on the average citizen not being able to have contact with other voices. Because once you have this dialogue going on with all these different voices, then you get into real change, and that's what they're afraid of. So there are a lot of people there that would be more than happy to hear what we have to say, but they're not aware.
Wow. John Ossie Markopoulos, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this great information, and thanks for taking on this work.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you for having your show.